Hey there, foreigners. This is Rohit from BreakingTheBorders.com, home of the ambitious immigrants. Today's guest is a hustler. He started very early and hustled his way to start several companies. His latest one is PeerHustle.com. PeerHustle.com is a location-based online marketplace for freelancers. Today, he's going to talk about how he started his first venture as a teenager and how to make some money by working less, and finally, how to build a content marketing platform without investing all your life in it. Ian, welcome to Breaking the Borders podcast.
So glad to be here. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
So, Ian, I want to know the businesses that you have built, but before I go there, I want to know the man behind it. So, where are you originally from?
So I was born in Kampala, Uganda, which is in East Africa. And as a kid, I moved with my family to America when I was about 8 years old because my dad was coming to America to do his doctorate in civil engineering. So the whole family moved along with him. And I've been here ever since then. I've been here going almost on 20 years.
So if your dad was a civil engineer in Uganda, was your family well off back there?
Yes, yeah. I would say my family was pretty well off in terms of Ugandan standards. Uh-huh. Then we came over here, then things were totally different, right? So we had a culture shock, trying to readjust. The whole family was staying on his stipend for school.
So your dad was a PhD, so he was getting a stipend which he had to use to sustain the whole family.
Right, yeah. So the first, we'd say, 4 or 5 years or so, he was a student, graduate student, and he was trying to provide for the entire family. So things were definitely different from the way they were back home, because back home, he was an engineer. He worked for USAID. They paid for most things. So things were totally different back then.
So what did it mean to you when you were growing up? What was different for you because your dad was going through that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the culture shock, just moving to America, right? So as an African kid, my parents were very strict African parents, right? And even the schools we were in, they were very strict. Mm-hmm. So every time you were out of line, they would send you to the principal's office and they would whoop you with a cane, right? Then I came over here and things were so laid back, so relaxed. And that was just totally different for me, trying to adjust.
I see. What happened when you asked for a new game or an Xbox or a Nintendo to your parents?
We know that they gave me the typical line, we don't have money right now, you know, maybe later on. So as a kid, that kind of made me conscious about, okay, we aren't really that well off. I should definitely try to make sure I can, in the future, I can provide for my family. I make sure I do well in school, make sure I have a good job. You know, they also gave me that entrepreneurial hustle to go out there and try to start my own businesses. That way, because I feel like the way to, once you start your own business, it's almost a way to kind of make sure you don't have to deal with that problem ever again if that business is successful.
Yeah. So when they said no to all these games that you wanted to buy, right? You were saying that it impacted you with your mindset later. But what you earlier told me was it impacted you at that time as well. What did you do as a 12-year-old that any other 12-year-old wouldn't do?
So as a 12-year-old, I taught myself how to build websites. I became a web designer. So I began off with Microsoft Front Page because that's what my dad had, because he got that via the school's educational program. So I taught myself how to build websites, began doing blogs and news sites on video games. And from there, I ended up actually finding some work as a web designer.
Who was your first customer for your web design?
My first customer was my uncle. It was in the family. It was just more word of mouth. So my parents kind of told my uncle, oh, our 12-year-old kid does websites. And my uncle was like, oh, really? You know, I've been trying to have somebody make me a website, and hiring this web design agency is really, really expensive, you know? So maybe you could help me out with that. So my uncle had a preschool, a kindergarten. So he wanted me to build a website for his different schools, and he gave me the content. I built the websites very easily. And from there, I ended up becoming a IT support. So every time you'd have issues with these computers at the schools, I'd go there and fix that, fix the networking. So he was he was in a way my first client, not just for web design, but also for just IT support and IT in general, and my first client-facing role.
So your uncle was not your only customer, right? So there were other people at that time as well. How did others learn about you and your work? Because you are only a 15-year-old who was not doing, or were you doing any marketing at that time?
Not really. I wasn't really doing much marketing.
So how did you get these other customers?
It was just mainly word of mouth. My parents, every time we'd go to different events in the neighborhood with family and friends, you know, they'd say, oh, you know, I'm trying to find somebody to help me build this website. They'd always say, oh, our son knows how to make websites. So I wasn't really actively looking for clients. They would just find me because back then I was busy with school and soccer and things like that. But people would still kind of find a way to find me.
Yeah. So your parents were trying to help you, or were they just proud of you that you're building websites and that led to more clients?
It was both. They're definitely very proud, especially my mom. She's always proud. And they were just also trying to help me find new clients.
What is the best payment you got as a web designer?
As a web designer, I mean, back then as a kid, it was probably a laptop because my uncle, I guess, trying to also save on costs, gave me a new brand new laptop. And at that time, that was my first time ever owning my own computer. Because up to that point, I was always borrowing my dad's computer to build the websites and do things like that. And at times, I'd also occasionally crash his computer and he would get mad at me.
Now you didn't have to worry about crashing someone else's because you had your own. What was the revenue that you made in total doing web designing before you moved on to other things?
In web design, it was about $2,500 or so. I mean, because I was mainly, in a way, I'd kind of barter and find other ways to get paid, like, for example, with a laptop. But as a kid, it gave me some extra spending money to use here and there.
Yeah, that's huge as a kid, right? As a 15-year-old, right. I would imagine that $2,500 is a lot of money because your parents are still supporting you and they're paying for your tuition and everything. So that is your extra pocket money to keep. How did it feel at that time? What did you use it for? Like,
oh, it felt great. I mean, I would use it for most likely, I think it was probably games, getting games, video games.
Did you buy a new console that your parents said no to earlier?
I mean, no, I would still wait for them to buy it. I would just buy the actual games, but not the consoles, because I figured my parents would eventually come around.
I see. So then you went to college and you took computer science in school, right, as an undergraduate. What happened in a computer lab conversation with your peer in the undergrad school that led you to start another company?
Right, so I had a very close friend of mine, Asad, and we were in computer lab one day. Class was over, but we were just kind of hanging out an hour or two. And then I began talking about business, and I told him how easy it was to build your own business. I kind of told him, I've read all these different business books. Here's the formula. It's very simple. You just start X, Y, and Z. You go all the way to IPO. Then he's like, okay, why don't you put your money where your mouth is, and let's actually start a business. So he called me out. He called me out right there on the spot, and I had nothing to say. So we sat there for about an hour or so, and I actually planned out and founded our first ever business at that point in time as college students, and that was Leximo.
So what is Leximo? What does it do?
So Leximo was a multilingual social dictionary. So think Urban Dictionary, but with videos, pictures, and real words. So you cross between Urban Dictionary and Wikipedia. And I would say, in a way, kind of Quora, like Quora, the question and answer site. Mm-hmm. So the whole premise behind that was I loved learning about different cultures and countries. And my friend Asad was a Washington, D.C. spelling bee champion in high school. So he likes learning about linguistics. So we got our two hobbies and passions and combined them together to just start out Leximo.
I see. So you were talking about the knowledge that you had about business that you were showing off to your friend in a way, right? How did you get that knowledge? Because you were in undergrad degree, you were in freshman year, you were less than 20 at that time. How did you know so much about business at that time? I believe, were you 20 still?
I was about 20. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 20 years old or so. So I loved business as a kid. I read lots of technology books. Read lots of technology blogs, lots of business books as well. So I felt that I had a a good understanding of businesses and how they ran and started. And also, as a kid, I always knew I had that business savvy, that a hustler mentality or mindset of being able to see things others weren't able to see. So at that point in time, all those different experiences I had made me very, very confident, to a point where I was too confident.
I see. So, what was your best business book or favorite business book at that time?
Oh, at that time, I think at that time it was probably Guy Kawasaki's The Art of the Start, which is a book on some startups and starting different technologies. That was probably my favorite book at that point in time. And also, I think it was Napoleon Hill, Think and Grow Rich. And
So.
also, there was Rich Dad, Poor Dad. I think it was Investor's Quadrant.
I see. So
So,
you got all these mindsets back from then, which you then apply to your business in Lexima.
right.
What happened to Lexima?
So Lexima was it was a very huge project for two college students trying to tackle. So, but it was a very great experience because I taught myself Ruby on Rails at that time and built the first prototype web application. We went out there, tried to promote it, pitch it to investors. We got lots of feedback. The most feedback we were getting back, they loved the idea, but they felt it wasn't really feasible because we had this very big, grand idea of building this world, this big data pool of just different languages and doing voice translation, artificial intelligence, and our website was just a simple prototype. So having two college students try to pitch that wasn't really feasible to investors' eyes. So from there, we ended up downscaling the idea and just put out an iPhone application, which was in the App Store for about 2 years or so.
How did that shift happen? Because it's not easy to agree to this thought that not everyone sees it as big and cut down, right? That's a very
Right,
hard
yes.
transition, I would imagine. How did that happen?
So it happened from two feedbacks in two different business competition we were in. The first one was on campus, where all the judges told us we had the best idea. Yet they didn't pick us for the final round. I mean, as the winners, because they felt that we couldn't achieve the idea. They didn't think it was feasible, even though I thought it was at that point in time. And it actually ended up being done by Google, with their Google Translation application, where you can translate from one language to a different language and vice versa. And then one time I was pitching at a DC event to venture capitalists, and we actually got into an argument on the feasibility of the idea. So I was there kind of trying to show him that it was feasible, we could do it, but he didn't really believe me at that point in time.
So what did he say that he didn't, that made you?
I mean, so his whole premise was he didn't believe computers could translate from one language to a different language via voice.
I see. And you believed in that. So what
Right.
was the taken, what was the simpler version of Leximo?
So we just downscaled just to a simple iPhone application where you could go view words into different languages. So it had the same manner like Dig. So the best definition for each word would get voted up, kind of like Dig or Reddit. So you'd go through, see the words, see the pictures, see the videos that go along with that definition.
I see. So you had this iPhone app and you released it. And how did you get people to use your app?
I was just mainly promoting. We had a blog. I would put up videos on YouTube. I would find some other people on campus to write for me and promote. But eventually, Lexham kind of fizzled out because I graduated, went to grad school. My co-founder went to medical school. So things kind of teetered off.
But at that time, at its best times, what was Leximo's biggest win, or in terms of users or in terms of traffic?
In terms of traffic, I think one month we got 25,000 or so in terms of traffic. We got mentioned in some articles online. So I think that was probably our biggest win. And actually, my biggest win as well, I think, is my experiences in Lexham actually led me to being hired by IBM. So it wasn't really based on my background, although I had a master's and bachelor's in computer engineering. But what they liked specifically was my experience being able to venture and take risks in starting something outside of my academic work.
Yeah, that is, why is that important in work life? I'm curious to know.
I mean, so my manager who hired me said he saw that I was very business savvy and I had that hustler mindset. And in the job where I work right now as a technical evangelist, it's a very client-facing role. So I have to go through the same experiences. So I'm always talking to crowds, hosting meetups, doing events, talking to clients, presenting, pitching, trying to sell them IBM products. So all the things I was doing with Bleximo, I'm now just doing under the IBM umbrella.
So the Lexima fizzled out. You and your co-founder parted ways, and then you wanted to get an expensive camera. How did you justify that purchase?
Right. So once again, going to just being very business oriented, I wanted to get a really expensive camera. It was about 2 grand. First, I was looking at the medium scale camera. I think it was just $700. But I really wanted the nice one, the really expensive one. But I couldn't really justify that to me. So I told myself, how can I actually justify this to me in a rational manner? So I told myself, what if I bought a $2,000 camera and then freelanced as a freelance videographer on the side? And made the money back. Then all of a sudden, I saw a way or opportunity to justify the expensive purchase. So I ended up buying the camera. And within the first year or so, I ended up making about a 7,800, 7,500 to almost 8 grand back. So I made way over my investment in the actual camera. And it just told me a totally different industry, totally different field, and different things about business.
Yeah, you made it sound very easy, right? So you got the camera and then you start. How did you start freelancing? What was your first step?
So the first step was just going out there and building portfolio. I mean, so I already had some experience filming videos. I used to film travel videos. That's why I wanted to get a really nice camera. But now that I had the camera, I'd first go out there doing event videography for free. So I'd go out there, film events for free,
So
build a portfolio.
how did you pick which events to go and film for free? So it's like an event that is already happening that you would go, or you would talk to the founders before, the event managers before, and then go there?
I was built. So, for example, I first began with DC Fashion Week. So I had been to DC Fashion Week earlier. So I would just kind of talk to the owner, the founder, tell him, "Hey, I would love to come and film your event." They would give me a press pass. I would go there, film the video, edit the video. Then I would send them the copies of the video, and they would post that on their website or their Facebook or social media sites. And from there, I just kind of began to develop a portfolio.
Yeah, and how many videos did you have to do for free before people started knocking on your door?
I would say, I'm not sure the exact number, but I believe it was for about 3 or 4 months or so. Then people began contacting me because I put a listing on Yelp. Then from there, people found me. And since I was a web designer, I knew how to build really nice websites. So from there, just kind of going back to being able to sell them my experience in my portfolio, they would contact me and we'll talk. And I really had decent rates at that time.
So what is the rate that you started with? You told me earlier, but you won't repeat it. What is the rate that you first started?
So I began off charging $25 an hour to film video. Then I quickly bumped that up to $50 an hour because I just wanted to value my time.
Yeah, you couldn't keep up with all the clients that you're getting at 25. Why did you start at $25 now to start with, actually?
Because I recall reading somewhere that the average range in the industry was 25 for beginners, all the way to $75 or $100 for experienced and advanced videographers. So since I was just starting out, I wanted to first start at the bottom and work my way up. But I quickly kind of threw that out the window once I wanted to justify my time. So I didn't really feel like driving all the way because I stay in the suburbs in Maryland. I didn't feel like driving 45 minutes or so to DC to film something for $25 an hour. So I just kind of doubled my rates from just based off of that.
And in the first year, you said you made more than 8,000 or about
Yeah, about
$8,000.
8,000.
And this is the time when you also got like ton of inbound requests that you couldn't manage it all by yourself.
So that was the year after that. So going my second year, going into the third year, I was getting so many requests that I couldn't manage. So from there, I had to actually hire an additional. I had to find somebody else to film with me. So I ended up hiring my brother.
Before you hired, did you again raise the prices from 50 to something else?
Yes, I mean, so from there, I recall I bumped to where I had a minimum of 250 per video shoot.
Okay.
So even if it was an hour shoot, my minimum was just 250 just to go.
I see.
So that way you could kind of justify my trips and traveling a lot more. And then I ended up bumping it all the way to $100 an hour to film, then $75 an hour to edit.
So, how did you get this idea to actually bump up the rates when you're starting to get busy?
Yeah, so I think I recall I got the idea from, besides just getting tons of requests from Grant Cardone. He's a business expert, where he was saying that, I recall watching some video where he said just double your rates, that most people undercharge themselves. So he said double your rates. So I doubled my rates just based off that one video. And I noticed that I was starting to get, I was making about the same money, but doing less work. So, for example, as opposed to doing 10 videos to make X amount of money, I could make the same amount of money just doing two videos or three videos. So I found that to be a better business selling point for me.
So how did you expand the company beyond just actually, did you incorporate it as your company or just freelancing still by
So
yourself?
actually, funny thing was, it was doing business under my Lexamo LLC.
I see.
So
Okay.
yeah, I still own the Lexamo LLC. So yeah, we were still incorporated just under Lexamo.
When did you start expanding the company to beyond yourself?
So yeah, so that was about 2 years or so into the company. I brought in my brother, and he would be an additional videographer with me. That way, there'll be two cameramen filming events. And then I also hired a professional video editor off of Elance. So he was the editor for that went to USC, University of Southern California, which is kind of like the Harvard for film editing. So I built a very automated process flow where we would film the videos, then I would send the videos to him via Dropbox. He would edit the videos and send back to me. And that saved me lots of time.
So at this time you were still doing the videos and you had additional help to do the videos and you had
Yes.
editing help, but you were still part of it.
Yes, I was, yes.
What was the revenue you made in video production in the second year?
In the second year, I mean, I think it went to about, I think it was 20 grand or so. It kind of varied about, around there, so about 20 grand or so. And now it's reached to a point where on a good month, because videography has phases, right? So springtime, summertime are really good. Sometimes actually most people are on vacation in the summertime. Then the fall time, people are really into video for some reason. So it has lots of seasonal trends. And on a good month right now, like my best month, I made about 7.5 grand or so. Actually, it was more than my regular job after taxes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So on some months, it's really great.
Do you still do the videoing or is it
Yes, I
completely
do.
outsourced? You do?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so I still do. I still film the video. And actually, now I'm kind of going back around to editing more video because
Oh.
I began to have some issues with just sending videos to my editors. So that was pretty interesting.
So how much time do you spend on a, you said on a good month you make around $7K in revenue, right? So I want to put that in perspective versus your time that you spend.
Right.
How
I
much time
mean,
do you spend?
so in terms of time, I would say about 10 hours or so every 2 weeks, so about 5 hours a week editing. So I guess I'm now at a point where I just keep raising my rates and I get less clients, but it's a very nice balance.
I see. So you are a true exemplary person for the 4 hour work week, right? So you got it
Yes,
to 5 hours,
right.
so
I love
one
that
more
book,
hour.
yes. Yeah, so I try to streamline everything under that philosophy of the 4 hour work week.
Marketing. You did a lot of Yelp marketing, right? Which I haven't heard from guests before. How do you market on Yelp?
So surprisingly, I just pay advertising. I pay about $350 a month on Yelp, and it gets me enough leads to a point where I would say 90% of my revenue is from Yelp alone, to a
Yelp
point
is
where
very
I don't
location.
bother much. Right, yes, so it's
Yelp is
location.
location based, right? Like, how does Yelp work for marketing for a non-location based business like yours?
So I actually do have a location. So I have offices on K Street in DC, about 2 blocks from the White House. And in a way, it's kind of like a Regis type office where you pay for office space, you pay a monthly fee. Then if you have to meet clients, you go there, reserve the space, meet the clients there. They handle your mail forward. They forward my mail to my home address. That way it protects me from having to list my real home address when I'm marketing my business.
I see. So you have a location where you pay monthly and they forward your mail, and that is the location that you use for your Yelp marketing.
Yes, correct.
Okay. So how does Yelp marketing work? When does the ad show up on Yelp?
So, for example, I'm a videographer. So, the way it works when somebody searches for videography or even photography, it will list my, it's kind of like Google Ads. So, it will list my ad, or I compete for the ads with other Yelp profiles who are also paying for the top spot. But then it will also show my ad on my competitor's page, which I think is probably the best value. So, when somebody is browsing or searching or going to my competition, they see my ad on there as well.
Is Yelp marketing new?
No, it's been there for a while, but surprisingly few people know about it or know how successful it is, because I was pretty shocked as well. So I only invested or took the gamble on Yelp because I had noticed that when I was in the first year or so, most of my clients or my leads were coming from my Yelp profile, not from my SEO or blogging or things like that. So I just kind of doubled down on Yelp, took that as a gamble, and I noticed I was getting a lot more clients who are actually paying a lot more.
And the quality of the clients was better too.
Right. Yes. So I've just from Yelp, I've gotten clients like congressmen. I've gotten USAID, the government. So they all know Yelp as the local go-to resource. So they just simply go on there to search videographer,
Ah.
and they see I have a nice profile, good reviews, and and they contact me based off of that.
And the fact that you are based very close to the White House also seemed to be helping.
Yes, it does.
So let me know if Obama
Definitely will.
calls you. So you did the video production company on the side while you're working full time, and you seem to be fairly successful as a side gig, right? What happened in the basement of your house that made you start Peer Hustle?
Right, so one day I was in my basement and I was watching Silicon Valley. I watched the first season. At that point, I had taken a break in being an entrepreneur, but it rekindled the fire in me. I got bitten again with the entrepreneurial bug. And I figured, let me start a business again. But I didn't just want to start a business just for the sake of starting a business. So I learned with Lexamo that we were a solution going around trying to find a problem, right? So it was just a business built on our passions. So I sat down, put a list of different problems I had during the course of my day, during the course of my week, and ranked them and said, okay, I'm going to solve this problem for me. So one of the problems I had was finding on-demand experts in a very quick manner in a local area. So, for example, let's say I want to have somebody give me medical advice without really having to go to a doctor's office or go wait in line. What if I could just call a medical student, ask him a question, and he will give me an answer? Or at that point in time, I was also trying to find a marketer to help me with promoting the first feature film. So having somebody I could call or Skype or meet in person over coffee and ask him questions was hard to find, because those people aren't really advertising on Yelp per se. Or if they are, it's a hassle. They don't have their pricing. Things are different. So I kind of got the concept of having an Uber type app for just getting local freelancers on demand, whether it's via video chat, phone calls, or in-person meetings.
How is it different from Fiverr or Elance?
Right, so Elance and Fiverr. So Fiverr is more for short-term online marketplace for getting short-term gigs. For example, having somebody build a website, record a voiceover. Peer Hustle is different from those sites in that it's purely mobile and it's purely local. It's based on your location. So similar in the same way with Tinder or Uber, based on your location, you go in there, you type in a skill set, it will show you people who have that skill set in your area. So if you type in web designer, photographer, videographer, it will show you their profiles, and you can view their profiles, you can contact them. We have built-in video chat, built-in audio chat as well. We have built-in escrow payments, so it's just one unified application for quickly finding people with any skill set and for having other people monetize their skill sets and make extra money on the side.
So the biggest difference is that you only talk to local people and you don't have to work with someone in Philippines or India to get your work done. You can do it locally.
Right, yes, yeah. So Upwork and Elance and those sites, they're designed more for outsourcing abroad, right? So ours is designed more for finding somebody near you mm-hmm. for work.
You were a computer engineer, so you must be familiar with how to build this product, but did you use your skills to build it or did you take help?
No, I didn't. I did not. So going back to the four-hour work week, right, I knew if I developed it myself, I wouldn't be really doing four-hour work week much. So I actually outsourced it to different sites. So I went online. I tried those other freelancing sites as well. So Elance, Upwork and stuff, trying to find developers. And they were just a complete hassle. Lots of people who didn't really live up to their hype. So I probably went through the three programmers who just couldn't really build Lexamo. So from there, I ended up finding a different site called TopTal. Initially, I knew about it, but I voted TopTal because it was very expensive. But after going through three failed programmers, and I was, I think, 3 or 4 months in, I got frustrated, and the sales reps were very aggressive, and they had this two-week free trial. So I figured, what did I have to lose? I tried out for 2 weeks. If it's not good, it was free. I move on, find something else. And I didn't really want to put my own effort in because I had so many different things going. Mm-hmm. I was working full time with IBM. I had my video production company. I travel a lot. And also just to kind of have ownership, because I know sometimes you kind of have legal issues when you build the code while working with a company.
Yeah.
So those different aspects where I wasn't coding, somebody else was doing it, really had a valuable selling point to me.
Yeah, that's a good point. There are a lot of issues with doing your own coding when you're working full-time as an immigrant also. If you have or on a visa, there are some issues as well. Was that a problem you had?
Not immigration per se. Okay. I have a green card.
Okay.
But definitely it was a factor in terms of just legal reasons.
Got it. So what is TopTal? I figured we didn't mention that. Do you want to quickly say what it is and then going right to what happened with TopTal?
So TopTal is a software developer marketplace where you can you can hire developers. but they have a very strict vetting process. So their claim to fame is that they hire the top 3% of software developers.
Yeah.
So they interview them, they give them tests to make sure they're competent in whatever skill set they say they have. And they also have a project manager or a sales rep in the middle who goes through and mediates between you and the developer.
I see. So you didn't have to go through the vetting process yourself. They already did it for you so that you get the best developer. I should be charging them for doing this, actually. But so you found a developer on TopTal and you were trying it for 2 weeks. What happened in those 2 weeks?
Man, this guy just blew me out of the water in the first week. He was a rock star. You know, I had gone through so many incompetent developers that I was surprised how good he was. Because I didn't really know how bad they were till I worked with him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it was easy to work with. Every time I'd ask for the code, he would show me the code. We would have live Skype sessions where he would break down the code. He was very fast in giving me things and going through the results. He was just an amazing programmer. And it gave me faith in TopTal that, okay, TopTal could help me build Pre-Hustle. So with that, we were able to build Pre-Hustle within 10 months and launch in October, the first version. And that was a blessing.
October of 2015?
Yes, October 2015 was when we launched. So I got the idea for Pre-Hustle April 2015, and it was in the App Store October 2015.
So you also mentioned earlier that TopTal was very expensive, right? How much did you invest in getting this app completely developed till October?
So with TopTal, I put in about 40 grand, uh-huh. then about another 10K just for the marketers. So 50 grand in total in terms of how much I put in Pre-Hustle. And that's constantly still growing since we're coming up with the new version. So that's going to go up as well.
I see. So then the marketers at TopTal contact you to get a testimonial. What happened when they contacted you?
Right. So they, one of the salespeople wanted to get a testimonial from Pierre Hustle because he saw how much I like Pierre Hustle. So I put in a testimonial. Then one of the marketing executives actually went to our website and said, hold up. This is also a freelancer marketplace. And although most of our clients were mainly photographers and writers, they saw that we were a potential competition. And at that point in time, they didn't really take us seriously when we were building the app. But once they saw that, okay, the app came out and it was picking up steam and there was some value in it and people liked it, then they chose to actually cut off contact with us where we couldn't use that developer to build Pure Hustle. So we're still on TopTal. We could use it for everything else, but we couldn't use it to build Pure Hustle because they felt we were a competition.
So they actually banned you from using TopTal for any new development?
For Pure Hustle, yes.
For Pure Hustle.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was a wrench. And I guess just one of the things you have to learn when you hire other freelancers to work on your idea.
Mm-hmm. So the freelancer went away and you're back to square one where you had to find a new developer.
Yes, yeah. So right now, we're now going through the different vetting process. We discovered a different site called Gigster, so we may try that out.
I see. So the tweaks on the existing app that is already built, is that allowed through TapTal or that is not too?
No, it's not allowed. Nothing at all. They did completely cancel the project.
Ah, okay. That must have hurt.
Yes, it did. You know, especially when it came from them wanting to give us wanting us to give them a testimonial. So that was very ironic.
Yeah. How do you get customers and freelancers to be on your platform?
So with Pure Hustle, all the way back to when I had just the idea, before I even dove and committed to the idea, I first tested this out. So I made a simple landing page, and I would post ads on Craigslist saying, hey, we're making a mobile on-demand freelancer marketplace app. Sign up here if you're interested. And we had over 150 people sign up in the first month just by posting ads on Craigslist. So that showed me, okay, there's definitely a market. And that was just in the DC metro area. So from there, we now kind of continue that where we try to get people from online sites like Craigslist. We have marketers who write blogs every single day. We have a podcast.
Yeah, you do some content marketing as well, right? So you are focusing mostly on DC area for now?
No. So during the launch, during the development phase, we were just mainly promoting in the DC. But now that we launched, we promote in all 50 states all over America. Since now Pure Hustle is national, and then the idea is with the second version, we plan to go global. So we'll scale up and focus all over the world.
I see. So far, your focus completely was to first get freelancers before the users.
Right. Yeah, so since it's a marketplace, we have the chicken and the egg problem. So the standard way to fix that is to first work on supply. Mm-hmm. So the first, since we launched in October, we've been working on getting freelancers on our app, on our marketplace, to a point now where we have almost 1,000 on-demand freelancers all over the country for different skill sets, mainly in photography and writers. Those are the two main industries right now. Since we would say we really cater a lot to creatives, since there aren't really other marketplaces out there that cater to them. So, for example, a videographer can't really get jobs from Upwork or Fiverr, per se. Yeah. I mean, they have Yelp and Craigslist, but those sites aren't really innovative in terms of the technology, like having the built-in video chats and phone calls and things like that.
What is your content marketing strategy?
So our strategy is we write blog posts, then we get those blog posts and we turn them into podcasts. Then eventually we'll get all our blog posts and turn that into a book. Uh-huh. Then we'll also get our podcasts and turn that into an audiobook.
Do you do it yourself?
No. So once again, following the 4-hour work week, I have writers who write everything. I have a voiceover actor who does the podcast and the editing.
So where do you hire all these people, help?
So those actually, I got those from Upwork.
Upwork, okay.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to know, the few experience I've had with Fiverr and Upwork and Odesk and Elance, either one end, it's either very expensive that I can't afford it if it is good quality, or if it is cheap, it's very shoddy work and I'm not happy. How do you find the right balance?
So I, after I post my jobs on there, I just go through a heavy vetting process. So I take time going through interviewing them, and I also have mock projects and mock tests.
What is your vetting process?
So the first thing is Upwork will suggest freelancers to you. So I have those apply, but I also go out there and search for my own freelancers. So I'll put in writer, or I'll put in, for example, a voice actor, and I'll go through and search all of Upwork, and I make sure that I hire people who have worked over 1,000 hours on there, whose success rating is over 90%, and I contact them and view their portfolio. If they're good, I invite them to apply to my project. Once they apply, I then have them do like a test, for example, either a test article or a test editing an image, or a test MP3. That way I can kind of see. Then if it's something good, then I fully hire them.
So would you pay them for those tests?
So sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. So it kind of depends on the size of the project.
I see. And do you recommend Upwork over others for finding freelancers?
Yeah, I mean, for short-term, for easy jobs like hiring a writer, mm-hmm. or finding somebody to edit your images to post on social media sites, to do online marketing or social media marketing. I've had a good experience with my podcaster and voice actor. But for developers, though, for the really technical things, it's a lot tougher. That's why I had to find other sites like TalkTal. Mm-hmm. So I would say it depends on the kind of project you have.
Yeah. I have to take some inspiration from you and try to outsource some of my work with this podcast as well. I will definitely take your advice on the way that you did using mm-hmm. Upwork. So thank you for that.
No problem.
Why don't you do it full-time, Ian?
So I love my job and also my jobs and my other ventures or businesses are also, in a way, financing Peer Hustle. I mean, I would love to do it full-time, but since right now we're not really profitable, we're still in that early startup phase where I'm putting in money. So once we reach critical mass and it becomes self-sustaining, then I could potentially do Peer Hustle full-time. But at this point, it's not really at that stage yet.
What is that for you? What is that critical mass for you?
Critical mass, big bank account. Okay. I mean, lots of users, but where I don't really have to worry about having money to keep it up and running. So I would say, even if it's bringing in, let's say, 20 grand a month or so, I mean, so right now we're not profitable yet. So we're just kind of, we're over-investing. We're putting all our money, all our resources into all these different areas, from growing, from partnering, from trying to get freelancers, now we're trying to build the next version.
Yeah. So you are completely investing on this yourself only, right? So you're retaining full ownership.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So right now I'm the sole owner.
Why don't you take outside investment?
I've thought about it, but I feel like, I mean, besides them also thinking that we have ways to go, I feel like it can become self-sustainable to a point where we don't even need outside investment. So because Peer Hustle has a built-in business model where we take 10% of the cuts of a project. So let's say you hire a freelancer for $500 or $1,000. We take 5% from both sides. So we have a built-in business model. So unlike my first venture in Luximo, where it was just it was almost a non-profit because we didn't really have a business model besides just trying to scale and get ads eventually. Mm-hmm. But with Peer Hustle, it has a built-in business model from day one.
Okay. So the model is such that it can self-sustain. So you see no real reason for outside funding, except you want to grow exponentially or something.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So once we've kind of figured out our metrics and we just want to throw gasoline on the fire, then maybe we can seek outside funding. But I feel like where we're going, we can definitely fully sustain it and almost not even need investing.
What advice do you have for other immigrant entrepreneurs?
I would say whatever idea you're thinking of working on, just dive into it. Don't think. Most people overthink things. They wait for the perfect moment. They want the perfect timing, but there is no such thing as a perfect moment or the perfect timing. You make it perfect by striking while the iron is hot, as they say.
Yeah, I'm a good example of that. I had this idea of a podcast with immigrant entrepreneurs in April also of 2015, and I waited till August to launch it. And most of it was getting over myself, and which is what you're asking people to avoid doing.
Right, yeah. I mean, I've discovered in life that whatever you think is going to happen rarely happens. So it's better to just dive right in and get real world feedback and then adjust.
That's a great advice, Ian. Dive right in and then adjust. If someone wants to find you online, what is the best way and connect with you? What is the best way to do so?
So you can find me on Peer Hustle. Our website is www.peerhustle.com. That's PEERHUSTLE. I'm always available via email. You can email me Ian, Ian at peerhustle.com. You can you can add me on LinkedIn, Ian Balina, IanBalina. And I'm always looking to connect and meet new different people. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
That was Ian Balina, the founder of Peer Hustle. His tips on how to outsource your tasks were golden. His passion for entrepreneurship is very strong and contagious. I feel the strong urge to go and do something right now. All the show notes from today's episode, you can find them at breakingtheborders.com/ENIAN, and make sure you subscribe while you're on the page to get latest updates. Until next week, stay ambitious.